Welcome to My Marvellous Melbourne, a podcast on Melbourne's history with Professor Andy May and the Melbourne History Workshop.
Great to have you with us for another episode. Gretel's going to kick us off with some snippets from the memory bank that take us down to the waterside. I have a chat with Stephanie Trigg in our It's Elemental segment about the history and meaning of bluestone in Melbourne's psyche. And Helen rounds us up in Archive Fever with an introduction to the Red Cross archives.
Welcome to the Memory Bank, where we keep an ear out for the voices of Melbourne's past. I'm Gretel Evans. Often, when we want to discover more about Melbourne's history, we disappear to libraries or museums in search of documents or objects that have survived from the past. But sometimes we just ask the people who lived it, just as we do when we want to find out about our own family history. Another way that history can be recorded and preserved is through oral history recordings. It's obvious that not all experiences are captured in the written historical record, so it's great when we have the opportunity to listen to people about their first-hand accounts. In the Memory Bank, we'll get to listen to snippets from some fascinating oral history interviews. The National Library of Australia has an extensive collection of interviews with people from all over Australia, including some people who remember living and working in Melbourne. In this episode, we'll hear from Henry Briggs, who worked on the wharves in Melbourne. Melbourne's foundation and development were very much linked to its maritime connections and capabilities. As its economy grew, so did its role as an important coastal and international port, especially in its early days when imports were essential for survival and growth. As Port Phillip Bay was not a natural harbour like Sydney's, the wharves stretched along the Yarra River, right into the heart of the city. In 1877, the Melbourne Harbour Trust was formed to address the urgent need of port improvements by widening and deepening the Yarra River and rebuilding and strengthening the wharves along the riverbanks. Port Melbourne continued to be an important centre throughout many changes and developments in the shipping industry, but one major change which we will hear Henry reflect on was the period of containerisation, which began in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Cargo was now shipped in containers rather than boxes or drums. Within a decade, 70% of the cargo was handled in this way. Port Melbourne's adoption of the container revolution gave it a major boost in the national shipping trade. Indeed, it was the largest cargo port in the Southern Hemisphere. But the high costs of operating container vessels led to less frequent port calls, which then very much changed the character of the waterside. Henry Briggs was born in 1918 and worked for many years on the wharf in Montague and Port Melbourne. As a locality in South Melbourne, Montague had grown up as an industrial area from the 1870s, with a railway station on the Port Melbourne line from 1883. As historian Susan Priestley notes, its strong community identity was focused around shops, churches, primary schools, workers' homes and hotels. And intense local rivalries were played out in larrikin gangs as well as on the sporting field. Henry's family was involved in show business. In 1945, after the Depression and the war, he started working on the wharf. In 1981, he was interviewed by Wendy Lowenstein and Tom Hills at his home in Port Melbourne as part of the Melbourne Waterside Workers Collection. You can hear the entire interview through the National Library of Australia, but here, we can listen to Henry recalling early details of his life growing up in a family involved in show business, his early education and life experiences in the suburb of Montague, which, as a residential locality, more or less completely disappeared after World War II. And then, we hear his subsequent reflections on what it was like working on the wharves and how much it has changed.
Well, where was I born now? I got an idea it was on a pitch at Carlton. We never had a residential address. Well, they were in show business. Mm-hmm. A carnival life, you know. Any variety shows at all which was going at the time, motorbikes going around the wall, all that business, bucking up in shows and everything like that, the usual run. Which they were at their time was the biggest showman here. By far, there was no one.
Yeah, it was well known.
What was the name of your show? The show?
Oh, Bridges Amusements.
And they still going?
No, it was a funny thing. They died out. It was just like a tree dying. Mm. They, the sons and that, some never got married. Those who got married had daughters, and no one to carry on.
And what sort of, what were your sideshows? What did you do?
Oh, merry-go-rounds, snake pits, boxing tents, motorbikes going around the wall of death. Mm. Everything. Embraced almost everything in show business.
But it's a pretty big show, wasn't it?
Oh, big show, big show.
Yeah, yours.
Oh, yes. They were in a big way, as I said. And in their day, they'd be the biggest showman in Victoria.
Did you go to school?
I only done, I think it was approximately, it might have been 2.5 years of schooling. That's the only schooling I ever done. Because there was an agreement reached in them days that showman's kiddies, your father would take on and he'd learn you. So, okay, the father, he took it on all right, but he said, now look, son, he says, this business about, I think it was algebra, history, and everything in them days, he said, all you want to do in life, he said, is be able to read and write. Well, I could always read and I could always write. Mm. He taught me nothing else. Mm. And that was about the limit of my education. Mm-hmm.
And how long were you with the show? I mean, did you have a home in a suburb of Melbourne?
We used to live down in Montague at the time. All these episodes there, one of the funniest ones I could recall down there is when we had a bull, because it was the biggest bull in the world.
Right.
you take that for granted, that's showman's. Mm. It was a large bull, but it probably wasn't the biggest in the world, but you bill it as the biggest in the world. Yep. That's showman's. Mm. That's what you call showbiz. And it ran amok down there once, and it charged the back of the house, and its head and shoulders poked right through the back here. So we're in the kitchen, pulled out the back of the house down.
Well, Montague was a waterfront area, was it?
Oh, yes, always has been, yes.
And what, did a lot of wharfies and that sort of thing went
down
there?
Oh, yes.
You always wanted to go on the wharf?
Oh, it was always in my mind to be on the wharf, because I used to sit down there, as I said, when we had nothing, and the wharfies would sit around there, you know, and they'd say, oh, I got a job, and how much they got, and it seemed to be a fabulous amount of money to me, which it wasn't really. No. But I suppose it was in the Depression, and I thought, well, I want to become a wharfie, you know, but it took a lot of, you know, what'll I do?
Wharfies are very generous people, aren't they?
Well, I would say very generous. I don't know about the day. I could not say the modern day wharfie. I don't know. Tom would know more about that than me. Because when containerisation started on the Melbourne wharfs, that was the death knell of the waterside workers. That was the death knell. 20 years from now, if you are, there wouldn't be much I could tell you about personalities, about the skills. All the skills was erased from the waterfront. People used to take pride in their flour stacking. Sugar, shortening a snotter. You'll never see again on the wharves where a ship will be in working 5 hatches at once and all the hatchmen there like a ballet dancer, Puritan, with all their fancy motions. Some had all this. That's all gone. The wharf has gone. Containerisation was the death knell of the wharves as Tom knew it and as I know it. Now, it's nothing. I could take my 4 little grandchildren down there and do it. There's no skills left on the wharf. The wharf's gone, as Tom knew it, whether he realises it or not. It's gone. 20 years from now, you couldn't tell the stories about the wharf, what I can tell, or Tom more so than me. I'm a later version than Tom on the wharves, because you were so close-knit on the wharves, and you walked around the wharves, you knew everyone. You worked 17-man gang. 8 below, 6 in the wharf, 3 deckmen. And in between your slings, you was down. You discussed your problems with each other. And you found out the weakness of each other. Or he'd feel you out. And you could find your weakness. You say, lay off him. Don't mess around with that bloke. He'll put you on your seat as quick as look at you. And it took that intimate relationship we had, Tom. Tom, you haven't been on the wharf since containerisation?
No.
It's not there now,
no,
mate.
I know.
It's gone. They're a different breed of men.
There's showbiz there, in that old Australian voice. There's also the camaraderie, passion and poetry of work, and an intimacy about being in the room with Henry as he talks to Wendy and Tom about his life working on the wharf. You can listen to the entire interview with Henry online through Trove and the National Library of Australia.
Welcome to It's Elemental, the segment where we get down to basics in terms of the way the city's made up, both in its environmental and natural form and its built form as well. It's a real pleasure to have with us Professor Stephanie Trigg. Stephanie is the Redmond Barry Distinguished Professor of English at the University of Melbourne, and in fact a Chaucer scholar in particular, but today we're going to lure her away from Canterbury for a moment and up some of the back lanes of Melbourne. Stephanie's got a long-term interest in the history of Melbourne's changing relationship with Bluestone, and in a recent article she wrote about this relationship that Melburnians have with Bluestone as a passionate one. And I know that passions and emotions are things that Stephanie's particularly interested in. But just stopping there for a moment, Stephanie, can you explain to us how we can have a relationship with a rock?
Rocks are notoriously important affective charges. Think about Stonehenge, one of the most popular British tourist sites. And in the context of Melbourne, Bluestone is both, it's under our feet every day. Most of us walk along Bluestone. We look down Bluestone laneways. We have Bluestone foundations in our houses, especially in the northern and western suburbs. A lot of our most important colonial buildings are made out of Bluestone as well. So it's a really strong part of the visual identity of the city, and that makes it easy for us to have an effective relationship with the fabric of the city in that sense. It really defines our sense of Melbourne as a glorious city, as a city with a strong heritage, and as a city that is very distinctive visually. Compared, for example, to Sydney's famous sandstone, which is all golden and bathed in beautiful light and seems to bespeak Georgian civilization, even though it has a strong undercurrent of a penal colony. Melbourne's Bluestone is dark. It's gloomy. People kind of love and hate it at the same time. So it's a really rich emotional site.
So if we did a kind of vox pop in the city and stopped people and said, Bluestone, what are the first sort of five words that come to mind, would it be that kind of somber, dark, I guess, emotional response, that sort of the kind of unsettling response almost that you have when you think about prisons and institutions and so on? Would it be mixed also with this sort of newfound heritage kind of consciousness that this is something wonderful and something to be sort of celebrated as a Melbourne thing?
I think on reflection, that's where people would end up. And I think probably one of the most dominant things in the CBD itself would be the idea of a Bluestone laneway. And that figures the cross currents across the main streets, Burke, Collins, Swanston, Elizabeth, those Bluestone laneways that thread behind, that are the secret back passages of the city. That's where waste used to be collected and where trash is still collected. But of course now it's a site of tremendous urban renewal. And again, that's something that Melburnians take very seriously as a sign of their cultural urban renewal. That's where the best coffee is found. That's where the little jazz bars are. That's where the independent fashion designers are. But that is also where we can get glimpses of the city's past.
Was the Lane's reinvention into this century as a great place and a feature of Melbourne, did that help Bluestone become a bit more, take on different sort of affective tones to it?
That's interesting. It's a bit hard to unravel the history of all this. The Bluestone is so distinctive, and so people like it for that reason. It's very difficult to walk on. It's very difficult to walk on in high heels. It's very difficult to ride a bike over. It's very difficult to wheel a pram or a wheelchair over. So there are all kinds of practical impediments to the beauty and the utility of Bluestone. So sometimes the council makes a real effort to relay the Bluestones. That in itself is controversial, even though sometimes that's better than just completely ripping them up and replacing them with asphalt, which would have been done in the 40s, 50s and 60s, 70s, I guess. Now we're tending more to preserve the Bluestone, but to relay it so that it's flatter. That can make it both more practical, but it also destroys a little bit of what people actually love about the Bluestone, that it seems to be something that is handmade, that is artisanal in some way, that seems to fit Melbourne's ethos as a distinctive Melbourne city. So it's a really mixed blessing. The councils now often mandate the keeping of Bluestone and the relaying of it, but sometimes there's now even a shortage of Bluestone. So sometimes Melbourne has had to import Bluestone from China, for example, to build around the MCG to retain the characteristic of Melbourne as a Bluestone city, even though it's not the local stone that was originally used to make the city.
I'm interested in the way that stone sits under Melbourne's consciousness, but also physically in relation to a kind of a north-south divide even. So when we think of those suburbs like particularly Brunswick and Northcote and Footscray, these are places where a lot of the stone came from for building Melbourne.
Exactly. You're right, it's a north-south and almost an east-west divide as well. So the bluestone that we built Melbourne on came from volcanic formations from the north of Melbourne and also the southwest down near Warrnambool Tower Hill. So there's kind of like two lava streams that kind of flow towards Melbourne. And they kind of stop at Dyke's Falls, where the Merri Creek meets the Yarra River. It's very interesting. You can go down to that point, stand on one side of the river on bluestone and look across to a completely different geological formation, which is sedimentary rocks on the other side of Dyke's Falls. So the bluestone is really a northwest and southwest phenomenon. So, yeah, Williamstown also a really important source of bluestone. We've done a little preliminary plotting of churches, which are often made of bluestone, and the vast majority of bluestone churches are to the north, the west and the southwest. East and southeast, they tend to be made much more likely of brick.
There is that association with prisons and particularly with Pentridge as the kind of archetype of that rough-hewn, rusticated, Gothic-style bluestone institution. What strikes you there in terms of Melbourne's relationship with Pentridge as read through stone?
That's a great question. It's when I first started talking about the Bluestone Project, and the first question for my friends would always be, are you going to write about Pentridge? So it does seem to be the real Bluestone landmark. And it figures very large in what I think I'm going to call the Bluestone imaginary. When you think of Bluestone, you do tend to think of that what's called baronial Gothic architecture. So that prison was erected in the 1850s, and it was kind of the walls were actually built by the prisoners. So it's got this terribly ironic, dark history. It was actually made by convict labour to house the convicts, and it rose up over the plains of Coburg, and it was just hated by the local residents.
I think that sense of the hardness of stone, obviously sort of naturally, but also the labour that's gone behind extracting and dressing and cutting and carrying and carting and breaking. It's that whole industry around quarrying and breaking of stones is something we've lost touch with and lost our knowledge of in a sense. But the labour that went into building roads and walls and so on is extraordinary. The prisoners at Pentridge built the prison. And
they were first lodged in stockades. These are kind of like really in huts, really. And so then they'll be sort of chained up and taken out to work on the walls. After a while, there was made a decision that the prisoners were not going to be allowed to work on the external walls, just on the internal walls in the prison, just for security reasons.
I think some of those early stockades were actually in, there was a stockade called the Collingwood Stockade in Carlton.
That's right.
And that where Curtin Square now is was actually the site of a bluestone quarry, if I remember.
Indeed. And under the Lees Street Primary School, there were recently excavated, I think, 10 underground bluestone prison cells. Can you imagine? Being sent to live in solitary confinement underground in dank, dark, grey bluestone. And now it's a primary school.
The hulks might have seemed like a better alternative.
Indeed, yeah.
But I love the way that the quarries and stone is the kind of footing to Melbourne. And a way that you can see that original landscape is by looking at some of the old Board of Works maps through the State Library website that date from around the 1890s, 1910s, and a lot of contemporary parks and shopping centres are built on old quarry pits. And it's a wonderful way of looking at your suburb and seeing if there are any old quarries around. There's an interesting character that you've written about, Stephanie John Price, who was I think particularly hated Inspector General of Prisons and someone that Marcus Clarke modelled a character in for the term of his natural life on. But he had something of a run-in with Bluestone, didn't he?
He used to be the superintendent up at Pentridge, and so he was in charge of the prisoners cutting and hewing up bluestone, sometimes to make blocks for prison walls. Sometimes the prisoners just had to cut the bluestone up to make road fill. They used to have to produce a square a cubic yard of road metal in a day just by breaking it up. But then the more skilled prisoners could get slightly better rations by learning how to chisel the blocks, chisel the bluestone into big blocks. And they would dig it up out of what is now Coburg Lake. So that's, again, one of those great ironic sites. It is now a beautiful picnic ground, but it used to be a kind of a bluestone depository, a bluestone mine, and then the bluestone would be lifted out and carried up to the prison to make for the walls. When the prisoners were recalcitrant, strangely enough, they didn't always want to be breaking stone every day. And they would sometimes then be chained to a big bluestone, which was later called John Price's stone. It was huge, and it had a kind of a bolt in the middle, and the prisoners would be shackled to it with their hands behind their back, and they would be punished, and they were given lazy rations, so their food rations would be reduced because they were unwilling to work on the stone. And this hatred of John Price really took a kind of a strong form, both at Pentridge and then also down at Williamstown. And there was a dreadful account of the murder of John Price. He'd gone down to inspect. There was some insurrection amongst the prisoners, again, being reluctant to work. Can you imagine, you know, working in the long heat, long hours of the day, cutting up bluestone, a dreadful, dreadful job. And he made the mistake of turning his back on the prisoners at one point, having been sent down there or gone down there to discipline them. And someone of the prisoners picked up a clod of earth and threw it at him. And then another picked up a bigger clod, and then more and more prisoners picked up stones that were lying around the quarry, and then eventually he was killed. And at the inquest, various accounts. I read through all these accounts and looking for the signs of the bluestone roll here. And it became very, very clear that when some bluestones were actually brought into the inquest with the blood and the hair of John Price still on them, mentioned as bluestones. So it was. I just wanted to get that final confirmation that it was actually a bluestone that had killed him. So this is a beautiful, ironic, poetic history.
Extraordinary. Isn't that amazing? Sense of the revenge of the stone, symbolically.
Well, very interestingly, yes, because a lot of the current discussion about material culture, about objects, about the life of objects in the world, often gets quite excited about that area of the agency of the material world. This is clearly a poetic form of agency, but it does seem that bluestone, you could say, had its own revenge on John Price, as well as the prisoners having its revenge. So that's quite a good story for thinking about, you know, what we're calling the affect or the affective charge of bluestone. And I guess in comparison to something like an emotion where we would think about hatred or fear or envy, affect tends to be somewhat less intellectualized as a concept, somewhat less linguistically bound, and often much more closely associated with a bodily response. So it's sometimes seen as being more powerful than an emotion because it sort of somehow gets under your skin. I think that's quite a good way of thinking about our relationship with bluestone and other forms of stone or the materials of the natural world, that we do have a kind of it's skin to stone. It's that kind of moment that I think is really important when we're thinking about what I'm calling the affective charge of bluestone.
Yeah, I love that sense of, as you say, the materiality getting under our skin kind of physically and symbolically. Mm. And the way that changes over time, of course, is fascinating. And a sense that bluestone kind of frames Melbourne through the geometry, through the lanes and the patterning, but also in this sort of deeply psychological way.
It's so weird. To me, it's quite contradictory. If I think about the Melbourne, you know, Hoddle's grid of Melbourne, all those geometric lines on perpendicular right angles cutting across each other, then I think of lines of bluestone. But then when I think about laneways, again, in my mind I see the unevenness of those stones and the way that they move and that they jump up. They don't stay flat, they jump up. They are hard to ride over, but their edges are actually quite soft. It's a stone that softens and ages. So even though the prisoners or stonemasons might carve sharp edges into it, the stone actually becomes quite soft, giving the lie, I think, to those Gothic, dark, penal associations that we have with it. Mm. And also the stone varies tremendously. The stone that we use for building, they prefer the stone that it's volcanic stone that cools very slowly. So it doesn't have bubbles and lines and holes in it. That's the highest quality stone. But I have with me, I'm just picking up that now to hold it, giving my effective touch with bluestone.
I was wondering whether you had a pet stone.
I have a pet stone, and it's a piece of basaltic rock that I picked up from the Merri Creek next to my house in Fitzroy. And it's deeply pockmarked. It's full of holes. You wouldn't use it for building. It would crumble. Bits of it come off of my fingers all the time. And this is a piece of bluestone full of holes because it cooled. It must have fallen very quickly into water and cooled quickly. So it's the complete opposite to the smooth stones that you would use, for example, on the National Gallery of Victoria.
I love that idea of the sort of biography of objects, that objects live different lives, and stones are the same. You must have come across some interesting examples of people collecting stone, or as a kind of a memorabilia almost of connections to places or buildings.
Absolutely. One of my favourite stories is from one of the curators at Melbourne Museum who moved from the western suburbs to the eastern suburbs. And when she moved, she took with her one of the bluestone pictures from the laneway outside of her house as a reminder of what the western suburbs felt and looked like. Yeah. And there are lots of stories of people stealing bluestone too. Somebody else told me, Delia Falconer, who wrote that wonderful book about Sydney, and she's got some wonderful things to say in that book about Sydney sandstone. She said that when she was living in Melbourne, when she first moved in, there was a council tent set up on the bluestone laneway beside their house. And she thought, oh, well, they're renovating the bluestone laneway. But in fact, it was people stealing all the bluestone pictures.
We can't end without asking you where maybe some of your favourite bluestone buildings or places are in Melbourne. If people wanted to go and look and get that sort of, you know, visceral sense of stone, what's a good place for them to go?
One of my favourite bluestone sites is a four-storey building down in William Street, which was originally built as a storehouse for wool. And it's quite an imposing building. And to me, it's reminiscent of the Medici Palace in Florence. The Medici were also wool merchants originally. So I think that there's some kind of link between the architecture of this wool storehouse, a very grand building, and Renaissance Florence. So I think bluestone is both a really local stone for Melbourne, but it does have this longer cultural history as well.
That brings us right back to the origins of Melbourne. I mean, the mercantile, mm-hmm. All those warehouses, the bluestone warehouses that lined the western end of the city, Flinders Lane and so on. So many of them now, of course, are not with us, but it does take us back to the economic foundations of Melbourne as an important sort of entrepôt to the region. So thanks, Stephanie, for putting a bit of stone into our hearts, and I think we'll be able to walk around Melbourne with a new sense of that emotional landscape that stone sort of brings to the city.
It's my pleasure. I'm also collecting people's stories about bluestone. If anyone would like to get in touch with me with their further anecdotes or pictures or stories about bluestone, I'd love to hear from everyone.
Welcome to the first My Marvellous Melbourne Archive Fever segment. The title, for those in the know, isn't a reference to the work of the same name by well-known French philosopher Derrida. It is simply a reflection of how we at My Marvellous Melbourne love archives. Although you'd be forgiven for thinking it wasn't directly related to the subject of our first segment, which happens to be the Australian Red Cross Archive. I'm Helen Morgan, and I'm an archivist, as well as an historian with an obsessive new interest in family history and tracing relatives through archives. And the Red Cross Archive ticks all those boxes. With me is Stella Ma, an archivist at the University of Melbourne Archives, where the Red Cross Archive is now housed. Stella wrote a great blog piece about the archive, titled, "Historic Records Are Not Relics, They Are Events Unfolding," which is certainly something I found in my family history research, so it's interesting to hear a bit more about the context and scope of this particular collection.
The Red Cross National Office and Victorian Division collections have been acquired by the University of Melbourne Archives, and these records cover the first 100 years of this historic organisation and map its vital contribution to medical and social welfare services, both in Australia and internationally. The collaboration that's made this possible to bring these records to the University of Melbourne will enable greater access to these records and our ability to use the really significant potential within them to investigate some quite complex subjects. I think it's important to remember that the reason why the National Office of the Red Cross Society is in Melbourne is because Melbourne at that stage in the 1914 was the capital not only of Victoria but of Australia. So the Defence Department was on St Kilda yep. Road. The Governor General was also on St Kilda Road. And it was only 4 months prior to the declaration of war that the new Governor General, Ronald Munro Ferguson, and his wife, Lady Helen, actually arrived in Australia. And what's really interesting is that many of the women who were in the leadership of the Australian Red Cross had yeah. had leadership roles already. So Lady Helen was the founder and president of the Fife branch of the British Red Cross. And so as soon as the war was declared, she, one, not only was in a position and was really comfortable with authority, she also had this enormous house at her disposal. So she established what was then the Australian branch of the British Red Cross, and she took over the house as the national headquarters. So the Grand Ballroom was an enormous warehouse of goods, pyjamas, socks, everything, bandages, everything that would be required to treat patients, to assist hospitals, and also packages for POWs. What we currently have and what is available for the public to read online, because all of our collections are listed online, would include the executive correspondence from both the National Office and the Victorian Division. There's annual reports, there's meeting minutes, there's publications, the Bureau, the missing Bureau, and that includes the 60,000 cards relating to mostly military persons, but sometimes civilians, who the Red Cross were facilitating the flow of information between the army, service personnel, back to families. So there is a vast variety of different record types within this collection. We also have posters and audio, but those two are still being processed and having conservation treatment on them. They were able to provide a service that the government and the army couldn't provide. Many of the relatives didn't have any contact with the persons who went into service for maybe 2 years. All the letters they sent, all the inquiries they made of the army came to nil. So the service that the Red Cross provided was central to morale both at home and in theatres of war. That lifeline that they provided between POWs and their families, who actually felt like they were involved in their continued welfare, is a feat that we can't underestimate. In Melbourne, there was a very early established philanthropy and social welfare movement, all sorts of different movements, and we have many of their records in the archive: temperance unions, social work charities, all those sort of things. And I think if you can view the Red Cross as part of that, you get a really interesting picture of the development of social welfare services in Australia. The very early philanthropy in Melbourne, of which many of our established families were part of, was really male-centric. And as you move forward and as these organisations like the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Red Cross develop, leadership roles in these very social organisations are opened up to women. Our service is open to academics, historians, and the general public. Our collection is listed online. The addition of the Red Cross, for me, has changed my view of the collection as a whole. What it really brings into focus for me is the interrelationship between activities. So the nexus between government policy, such as the administration of PNG, mining interests, we have the Bougainville Copper Mining Limited papers, and then the Red Cross in terms of their relief and development refugees from Bougainville after the civilian uprising. I think seeing that cause and effect between collections, and the same can be done with East Timor, because we have the Malcolm Fraser Collection, David Scott Collection, CICD, which is really vocal in the East Timor independence debate. Those interrelationships between archival collections are, for me, the most exciting. And with the Red Cross, given how sweeping its remit has been over the years, and it has changed certainly through wartime and peacetime, that is for me the most exciting thing. And to see how we can use resources like the Australian Women's Register to tease out those stories and show how these things connect. The Red Cross is a lot more than world wars. And I think it's very important for people to see the immense diversity that they have achieved in their service, from Cyclone Tracy to development projects in the Asia-Pacific region. One of their current campaigns is around working with the UN to prohibit and eliminate nuclear weapons. We have always had war, and the Red Cross are so aware of the impact of nuclear war. They've now taken a very big stance, and in this current climate of renewed bluff and missile launches, I think it's really sobering to see an organisation which has fought for so long to care for people now actually advocating for that type of weapon to be eliminated.
Stella described the archive as creating an opening of the nexus between government policy, consumer demand, business interests, civil war, refugees, and humanitarian organisations. And I'm sure you'll agree, it really does give us a unique view of these aspects of our history.
My Marvellous Melbourne is a production of the Melbourne History Workshop in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne, Australia. Our thanks to Gavin Nabar at the Hallwood Recording Studio, University of Melbourne, and Andrew Batterham for our theme music. You can find episode notes, further resources, and contact details at our website, mymarvellousmelbourne.net.au. We'd love to hear from you.